This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, the Republican Convention is history. We'll assess Mitt Romney, Paul Ryan, and Clint Eastwood talking to a chair.
What do you want me to tell Romney? Can't do that to himself.
Plus, what role are lies playing in this year's campaign? And we'll preview the upcoming Democratic Convention. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture Gap Fest, Sleepwalk With Me, can a movie born from a This American Life partnership make it in the wider world? Also, will you marry me? No pressure, but the whole world's waiting for your answer. Assessing the online marriage proposal. And finally, has reality TV found a new low?
I can't wait to go to the pageant because we're going to win it all.
What the new hit show Here Comes Honey Boo Boo says about us. We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz, the editor of Slate. My life, a dull, adventureless journey from one entitlement to the next. A government-planned life in a country where everything is free but me. I'm joined by John Dickerson, Slate's chief political correspondent and political director of CBS News, who is still in Tampa, Florida for the moment, attempting to recover from eye damage caused by staring directly into the blazing white teeth of a Romney sun. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And back from vacation on four different continents, one of which hasn't even been discovered yet, is Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Emily, it's so nice to have you back. Hello.
Hey, I'm so glad to be back.
Three topics on the GabFest this week. First, Mitt Romney's speech and the convention. Did it make him seem human? Second topic, Paul Ryan and the question of lying. Paul Ryan made a dazzling debut at the convention in Tampa, but did he tell the truth? At least, did he tell enough of the truth? Does it matter? Are we in a post-fact political world? And finally, the Democrats are preparing their counterattack. What will they do in Charlotte next week to rebut the Republicans? So before the traditional balloon drop and the parade of cowboy hats and women in fire engine red suits, Mitt Romney gave a speech to close the Republican convention in Tampa. Let's listen to a little bit from it.
President Obama promised to begin to slow the rise of the oceans and to heal the planet. My promise is to help you and your family.
Did this speech, John Dickerson, succeed in making Mitt Romney seem capable, human, and trustworthy?
Yeah, it probably helped a little bit. I feel like after this, the race is kind of where we were coming into it. The latest CBS poll, 32% of the people surveyed said they couldn't form an opinion of Romney. To the extent that those 32% paid any attention, either directly watching it or filtered through the news coverage, it was a chance for good impressions to land on those people. But those people are probably likely to have their impressions changed easily as they engage with the race in different ways. So it was a good first impression for Romney with those voters. He probably got a second look from the former Obama voters who were not too happy with the current president. But it all feels pretty soft. It was not a grand slam for him. And we can go into more detail about that.
So, Emily, it seemed to me that the theme of the convention basically was you were so full of hope 4 years ago. Now, you American voter, you're disillusioned. Here's an alternative. Does that work as a full campaign message? Is that going to be enough to get people out to vote for Mitt Romney?
I mean, it's the right place to start. It gives people permission to kind of break up with the president. That seemed like the big theme, that it's time for a divorce and you shouldn't feel badly about deserting him. But then I think it's the fleshing out of the alternative. And to the extent that those specifics are alarming or compelling, right, that's where the race should end up landing.
So you're not so concerned, or you don't think it's such a big deal that they make Mitt Romney into a three-dimensional person, that the convention's job was to show him as a father, a church leader, a hard worker, that part is not that important.
I think they did that. I find the narrative of Romney as like a Superman who's going to save us to be much more believable, actually, than the idea that he is ordinary in any way. And I think they kind of went for both of those views of him, and that they got evidence of both of those out. But I'm not... I'm, I don't know. He still is his, like, stiff wooden self, right? If you're just watching him for a few minutes and not paying attention to the whole thing, maybe you would care. I would think you might care a lot more about this idea of, like, look, Obama's stimulus plan did not provide all the jobs he said it would. We have all of these unemployment problems, and I'm the one who's going to fix them.
Wait, so, John, actually, from the convention, did it seem that they were trying to make him the Superman or trying to make him the ordinary guy? Or, as Emily said, were they trying to get both of those things in there?
No. Yeah, I don't think they were trying to say he was the ordinary guy. I think they were trying to say that he's not a stainless steel person, that he cares about other people and that he has these moments in his life, big patches of his life, where he's contributed lots to his community. If you think of the equation that is necessary for him to be elected, one, people have to become disillusioned with the president and the economy, and two, they have to feel safe and trust Mitt Romney to handle the presidency. The first is almost a gift that was waiting for him in Tampa. People are disillusioned with the president, his performance anyway. And the second, though, is one Romney still has to work on, and he has to particularly work on it with women. And that's a much more complicated thing, making it so that people will trust him enough to go vote for him.
What's so funny to me is that this Republican Party is so in the thrall of its populist instincts that here they're presented with a candidate who 30 years ago was like the perfect, or 40 years ago would have been the perfect Republican presidential candidate, and they have to dress him up as the son of an immigrant, which he, I guess he is nominally, and a guy who's self-made, which he kind of is, and he's an ordinary guy who ate tuna fish and his wife struggled. The fact that they can't let his noblesse oblige, that his grand life just sort of stand for itself, is a picture of how far this country has come and how far the Republican Party has come from its roots as the patrician party.
Well, that's not but the Republicans are fine with who he is. He's not trying to get Republican votes by sending all that. He's trying to do the same thing Bill Clinton did in 1992 when he introduced himself as the man from hope. He's trying to reach out to people who are not in the Republican Party.
Right. But I mean, to David's point, George H.W. Bush, we have these men who are raised with a lot of privilege and, they're self-made kind of, but also had a lot given to them along the way. And yet that's just not the way you connect with ordinary Americans. And so then they have to come down off their porch steps.
So, John, hands down, the weirdest moment of the convention was the mystery guest speech from Clint Eastwood, who did well, describe what he did.
Well, yes. This was the mystery guest who turned out to be a mystery even to himself. But so Clint Eastwood came out in the primetime hour, and this was a big surprise. And he was supposed to speak for 5 minutes. He went on for 12 minutes with no script, kind of meandering, making the case for throwing President Obama out. He, during the middle portion of it, pretended he was talking to the president himself in an empty chair. He seemed to lose his way a few times. He seemed at one point to suggest that it was the president's fault that we were at war in Afghanistan and that the United States hadn't learned the lesson of the Russians. He said that he didn't like attorneys. Romney also has a law degree.
That was particularly awesome.
Obama. It was just confused. He suggested twice that the president, who he was pretending to listen to, had suggested that both he and Romney have intercourse with themselves. And it was just, it was just a total cringeworthy, and as Dave Weigel beautifully put it, it was like the drunk best man toast at a wedding in which he details all of the women that the groom has slept with.
On national television.
Right. Well, the red light was blinking after about 5 minutes, and then it just went steady red, and he still didn't leave the stage.
So the other big event of the convention this week, besides Mitt Romney's speech, was, of course, the speech of Vice presidential nominee Paul Ryan, who came out and gave what, in my view, was a real barn burner of a speech. Let's listen to a brief passage from it.
If you're feeling left out or passed by, you have not failed. Your leaders have failed you.
The Ryan speech, of course, ignited a huge debate about whether the Romney campaign is telling the truth. In particular, Ryan was dinged for telling lies or certainly misrepresenting facts about the GM plant that he said had closed essentially because of President Obama. He misrepresented what happened with the bipartisan debt commission. He offered misleading information about Medicare cuts that President Obama had proposed that the Romney and Ryan both also essentially have endorsed in other matters. So, John, in the wake of Ryan's speech, people on both the left and the right, I would say, are talking about this as a kind of post-fact campaign where almost you have your belief and you choose your facts rather than your facts dictating your beliefs. Are we in a situation where campaigns can more or less say what they want, and indeed the vice presidential nominee can more or less say what he wants in a campaign speech?
Yeah, I think we are, and we've got you almost, you know, I think I've said it before, but if you're not getting four Pinocchios, you're not doing it right, which is to say you want to make the more outrageous claim because low-information voters who are just wandering by the TV are hit by an outrageous claim, and they don't stick around for the fact-checking. This came up both in the context of Ryan's speech, which had a number of either fibs or outright lies, and then in a symposium I was in, I got with Ron Fournier of the National Journal, got into a debate about the welfare ad the Romney campaign is running, claiming that Obama had weakened the work requirements for welfare. And this is an ad that's been fact-checked to death, and nevertheless, the Romney campaign continues to use it. The pollster from the Romney campaign said, we're not going to let the fact-checkers run our campaign. So they're not showing any desire to stop running this ad.
What I don't quite understand, Emily or John, is that there are so many bad facts about the economy and about the Obama administration that if you are a Republican, you can choose. Why not choose those? Why invent some?
Not as powerful. The welfare ad goes right to, and this is Ron Fournier wrote a piece about this, but blue-collar white voters, it's a very charged issue. And if you can charge that the president is making it easier for African-American people to get free checks, you're going to get some people to vote who are, you know, lukewarm about your candidate.
Can we provide some context here? I mean, we barely even have welfare anymore. It's not an entitlement. The rolls are way, way down. It's temporary. It's basically, you get some small amount of money for trying really hard to get a low-income job. There was a bipartisan group of governors who asked for a little more flexibility in exactly how they implement the work requirements. It is clear they still have to do that. But also the whole context for it is made up.
So, John, is the Obama campaign pursuing the same mendacious lying strategy that the Romney and Ryan campaigns, or are they more truthful?
It depends. So the Obama campaign is running an ad that says Mitt Romney would restrict abortions in all instances, even though he's repeatedly said over this campaign that he believes in an exception for rape and incest. But what the ad says is, oh, no, because he said he supports the Republican platform, they say that means he doesn't believe in any exceptions. So what they're doing is essentially what the Romney people are doing with the welfare, which is take the most dire interpretation of any piece of data and then assume that it's already happened. And they've run ads on abortion for the same reason. They want to get suburban women to think that Romney is basically the first thing he's going to do in office is put in further restrictions on abortion.
Emily, if we're in a post-fact campaign, what role does the media actually have?
You know, I think we should be doing more of what NPR was talking about when they changed their ethical standards. I think last year they said, look, we're not necessarily going to do he said, she said. We're going to do what is actually true and, you know, be kind of have our allegiance be to the story and to getting the truth out as opposed to just having the debate happen and sort of stand back from it. And I think we're starting to see more of that. But I have to say, the fact that the Romney people won't back off makes me wonder how effective this is going to be. But I think we really have to try.
All right. We will try. We're going to try really hard. We're going to try. Coming up, Democrats prepare for their convention and try to stop a Romney bounce. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC.
Thank you.
This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. We're moving on to the Democratic Convention. The Republicans had their moment in Tampa. Now the Democrats are going to Charlotte. No hurricane yet, as far as I know. Any hurricane, earthquake planned, volcano eruption?
No, but I think there may be a few locusts that are having a caucus and deciding what they're going to do.
So I think when we think about this Democratic convention, you look back at the convention in Denver in 2008, which was huge and epic and incredibly exciting for Democrats. And going into Charlotte, there's certainly not the same sense of enthusiasm. Obviously, President Obama is a known quantity, and the things are not as glorious and optimistic as they were then. But Emily, what is it that the Democrats can hope to get out of the Charlotte convention?
They need to get the sense that it's Obama who's going to be the one to fix the economy. Some sense that they've kind of reproved that he is the person people still trust more than Mitt Romney with those numbers. And I think to do that, they have to address this "you did not build that" quote, which got so much mileage at the Republican convention. And I think, you know, I went from being kind of enraged at the way the president's remarks were being edited to change their meaning to feeling like, you know, this really does reveal a deep divide between conservatives and liberals or moderates about how they see the work of the government. And the Democrats need to take it on head on, I think.
John, is that right? They've got to attack the "you didn't build that"?
Yeah, I think so, because it's what the Romney campaign underhandedly edited the quote in a way that makes the president look horrible. But if you pull out and look at the context of the quote, there is something in there that has nothing to do with that part and the "you" building and everything. But when he talks about, you know, people who started their business, they think they're so smart. Well, I know there are a lot of smart people. That is the line that's actually much more damaging. That is the line that suggests to the, you know, person who's just trying to start their little small business that they have a kind of inflated sense of themselves. And that's where you get into values and rich territory in terms of what makes people angry about this idea. And I think he does need to address that in some fashion, because it suggests to the swing voter that he's out of step with a kind of an American current, and he needs to get back kind of in line with that, which is totally separate and apart from where his policies
so
fall.
Here's the thing that baffles me about the Obama campaign, is that the Obama campaign, as far as I can tell, has been an attack campaign around Romney and Romney's Bain experience and maybe Romney's taxes. That's one part of it. And then there's been a plain defense around the economy and also around the "didn't build that" meme. What I don't get is that in 2008, it was very clear to me what the Obama campaign was running on. It was sort of a "yes, we can, hope, change" theme. There is nothing, there is no theme to this campaign. If you ask me, what is the Obama campaign slogan? I have no idea what the Obama campaign slogan is. I have no idea what it is that they are trying to tell me, other than that I shouldn't vote for Mitt Romney.
Forward.
Forward where? Going where?
I know, exactly. But, well, hold on. I think there is you can make a case for what Obama's actually running on. But let me ask you about the past. I mean, what did hope and change mean?
What?
In real terms. I mean, you knew the slogan. You knew the good feeling and the warmth in the tummy. But what did it mean for you in terms of a kind of specific set of policy proposals other than leaving Iraq?
Well, it was supposed to be this bipartisan approach where Washington joined hands and came together. The problem was, of course, that totally never came to pass, and the president has had to back away from it.
Partly
but in that,
that
no,
moment, but it, no, there was a health care portion to it. There was the war portion to it. There was a health care portion to it. There was an environmental portion to it.
Energy portion, yeah.
There were clear elements to that campaign, and there was an overarching "yes, we can, new era" kind of thing. And I just don't – I have no sense at all about what it is that President Obama is proposing that he will do in the next 4 years, or what it is that entitles him to be in the White House for 4 more years. I mean, I certainly think he deserves to be, but there's not a message that I've received. Now, I live in Washington, D.C., where no one puts any ads on the air, so it doesn't really matter. But I'm just curious.
I'm not sure you would know from the ads.
One of the problems here is he still is not running on healthcare as this signature accomplishment that he's really proud of. And then the stimulus, its problems have to do probably with the idea that it was too small rather than too big. But he can't run by saying, look, here's my record. I restored all these jobs I promised to restore.
That's absolutely true. But he still, even if he could do all those things, he would still need to have some kind of positive agenda going forward. And his best argument is that, although he can't really say it out loud, is that, you know, we are in a time of scarcity. There are going to be lots of hard choices that have to be made in budgets and, you know, starting very soon into the next term. So who do you want fighting to make sure that when those hard choices have to be made, and they're going to have to be made regardless of who gets elected, because if they're not, the hard choices will be made by reality. Who do you want in there fighting to make sure that you're somehow at the table or somehow protected? Because, you know, Mitt Romney is going to protect his people and, you know, I'm going to protect you. So that's it doesn't line up to a specific set of policies, although he tries when he talks about Pell Grants and certainly Medicare and that kind of stuff. But it's not a kind of I'm going to take you forward. It's sort of I'm going to protect you, which is not a very doesn't work in a campaign context.
So, Emily.
And is that because, John, it's too pessimistic and dark? That's the problem?
Yeah, nobody wants to hear that stuff's going to be hard and choices are going to be difficult and that change is going to happen.
So, Emily, in 15 seconds, what is it that the Democrats should come out of Charlotte with? What is the message that they want to leave the American people with?
We're the ones who understand you and we're going to fix the economy, even though we failed to the first time around. But really, it was all President Bush's fault anyway.
That was pretty good in 15 seconds, although I think they've got to leave out the Bush part because that living in the past business is not wise. Now let's go to cocktail chatter when you are sharing a near beer with Mitt Romney and he is talking about his great convention speech. What are you going to talk to him about, John Dickerson?
Well, I guess I would tell him this is about a man he'd like to, in whose footsteps he'd like to follow. I was writing about the presidency and went back through Robert Caro's early books on Johnson, and there is a there's actually a website where Rick Caro writes about his process, the 3 years he lived in the dry, barren part of Texas that Johnson came from, and he describes what it was like to bring electricity to this area that Johnson came from. He talks about these women who, until electricity was there, had to carry water, pull it up from a well, 70-pound buckets, and it stooped them. By the time they were age 50 from hauling this water, they were bent over, and it is just a fantastic description, and for anybody who wonders why these books are so great, you don't have to be interested in politics. They are just beautifully told stories.
Emily, what is your chatter?
I just read a new book called You Are the Love of My Life by Susan Shreve, which was such a gem. It was a gem of chick lit, if you make that genre big enough to include some really good, meaty books. And what I really loved about this book is not just the women and the characters, and it's very kind of domestic and interior, but it was also about the organism of a neighborhood, specifically, although she gives it a different name, but I think she's really writing about Chevy Chase, D.C. But what I really loved about this book is not, you know, the D.C. part of it. It's the idea of the neighborhood and of the way in which there are particular, usually women, people who become kind of neighborhood mavens who other people rely on in all these informal ways and who can do an enormous amount of good, but also a lot of meddling in ways that can actually be pretty destructive.
My chatter is, given the wonderful discussion about the role of women that the Republican convention raised, in particular the way that Ann Romney's work in the home was valorized, I came across a fantastic letter from 1777. It was a letter sent by a woman named Lucy Knox, who was married to Henry Knox, who was a general, ended up as George Washington's number two, and then later was Secretary of War. At the time, he was a young general, and he had just married this woman, Lucy Knox, and she wrote him a letter about what would happen when he returned home from war. And here's what she wrote. She wrote, "I wish that you had less of the military man about you. You might then, after the war, have lived at ease all the days of your life. But now I don't know what you will do. You being long accustomed to command, it will make you too haughty for mercantile matters. Though I hope you will not consider yourself as commander and chief of your own house, but be convinced that there is such a thing as equal command." I just love this idea of equal command in the house, and that here's this woman 240 odd years ago just warning her husband, the great general, that when he comes back, you know, you're used to commanding in the field, but when you get home, enough already.
Put you to work in the kitchen.
Exactly. So that'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. I'm David Plotz in Washington, turning things over to Stephen in New York.
Thanks, David. I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture GabFest, There Are Some Broke Down People Out There edition. On today's program, the new TLC reality show, Here Comes Honey Boo Boo. And what does it say about, well, fill in the blank, us, humanity, democracy, you name it. Sleepwalk With Me, the new indie movie co-written with Ira Glass. And finally, the virtues and demerits of public marriage proposals. Joining me today are Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens.
Hey, Steve.
Julia, are those aren't yoga pants, are they?
Oh, I'm on vacation, Steve. This is a special break from vacation. I'm wearing yoga pants. I'm wearing New Balance sneakers. This is my office attire for the day.
You're phoning this one in is what you're telling me.
What was that? All right. Are we talking about?
I'm going to start with Dana on this subject then. Okay, so just in case you've recently regained your faith in humanity, never fear, cable TV has a program for you. Here Comes Honey Boo Boo is the new reality show on TLC. It's in the kind of can't watch it, kind of can't turn away model of Jersey Shore. It's about a family in McIntyre, Georgia. It centers on the eponymous Honey Boo Boo, the six-year-old Alana, who is serially entered into child, I guess, beauty pageants by her mother, June. Why don't we listen to a clip of the show and then we'll dig in.
I want to have children when I grow up. I want to have thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands. Third, 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 fourth, third, fifth, third, sixth, third, seventh, third, eighth, third, ninth, 30.
All right, Dana, let's dig right into this crazy and spectacularly weird television show. You watched it. What did you think of it?
Well, I think it's worth mentioning also at the beginning that it's a spinoff of a previously existing show, right? So if you're interested in seeing kids competing in beauty pageants, you already have a TLC show called Toddlers and Tiaras. And I guess Alana, this character who's nicknamed Honey Boo Boo, appeared and was a big hit on Toddlers and Tiaras because she's such a hammy little girl. She's 6 years old and she loves to be on stage. And so she gets her own show, which, not having seen Toddlers and Tiaras, I can't talk about whether it ups the ante, but this show is a crazy mess. It's almost hard to know how to emotionally or aesthetically react to it because it's such a crazy mix of kind of white trash comedy and class voyeurism and schadenfreude and cloying cuteness.
And pig reaction shots.
Right. There's a baby pet pig that Alana adopts in the third episode.
Rolling through the background.
Right. A lot of emphasis on the fact that their small house in McIntyre, Georgia is right on the railroad tracks. I mean, to me, there was so much cruelty in what I'm calling the class schadenfreude. And I found the show really hard to watch, not so much because I found the people in it unbearable, but because I found the relationship presumed between the viewer and what was being viewed objectionable, if that makes sense.
I think you've put your exact finger on it, Dana. There's been a really interesting debate. I mean, first of all, the show is a wild hit. It's much more successful than Toddlers and Tiaras that it's spun off of, which is itself a pretty big phenomenon. And since it has become this popular show, there's been this sort of debate of first people saying, this is outrageous. How dare this pageant mom feed her daughter go-go juice, which is a mix of Red Bull and Mountain Dew or something before pageants. This is a bad family. This is bad parenting. Scorn, 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 scold, scold, scold. And then there's been a series of backlash pieces, of course, saying, look, if you examine this family, they are really interesting. They are entertaining to spend time with. They seem to be a very close-knit family that's, you know, exhibiting good parenting skills and actually kind of a good role model. And I think there's definitely some truth to that. I think June seems kind of like a great mom in a lot of ways. But the scorn that the producers seem to feel for her and her rolls of neck fat and her eating habits and even the way that they shoot in the episode I watched, the family was sneezing. Maybe a couple people in the family were fighting a cold. And instead of just cutting away from the sneeze, they would do if it were, you know, Anderson Cooper between takes. They just watched them sneeze as though, like, look, the specimen has bodily functions. Mm-hmm. It's gross.
Am I wrong to say that that's maybe a first-order reaction to the show? And a second-order reaction to the show is to note that there's a degree of reality TV savvy on the part of virtually everyone now who appears on reality TV. They themselves have consumed the genre. They're very aware of what kinds of role-playing are expected of them by the producers. It's very hard in this day and age to break it down so simply as to say that there are super savvy coastal elite media people
who are dealing with regular citizens as specimens. What struck me about the show was how hammy and self-conscious the performance is on the part of the family that's being filmed in a way. And it seemed to me that that reversed the roles a little bit, that the savviness of the family started to seep through, and that drained something of the exploitative nature of the show in a way. That redneck, for example, is a word that's being thrown about and embraced over and over again in the same way that Guido is a word that was thrown around and embraced on Jersey Shore. Dana, do you buy that at all?
Yeah, I think it would be hard to call the show pure exploitation of the family, given their obvious willingness to participate in the show and the fact that from the get-go, there are people who enroll their six-year-old in beauty pageants. But the condemnation of the mom seemed sort of absurd to me. I mean, if you want to say that having your kid in beauty pageants and a reality show is de facto sort of child abuse or exploitation, that's one thing. But I think her parenting skills in the show seem perfectly fine, and they seem like a sort of sweet family that was having a lot of fun being on television.
Julia, what is it about child beauty pageants that touches a very specific nerve among the kind of people who believe they would never consider putting their kid into one?
I think it meshes with the idea that's common in parenting culture that American kids today grow up too fast and they're too interested in makeup and they want to be sexy too soon, girls in particular, and that beauty pageants emphasize all the wrong things. They take, in this case, a six-year-old girl, and there's a moment where she needs a new glitz dress because she's gotten too chubby for her old glitz dress, which is, I guess, what they call the pageant performance outfit. And as it gets adorned with more frippery and epaulettes and all kinds of beautiful gemstones, she gets more and more excited. And you can see her lavishing attention on her own reflection in the mirror. And you can recognize any hammy little girl you've ever known who's sort of entranced with sparkles and pink things and the idea of herself as a fairy princess. But it also, she starts swiveling her hips. She's pursing her lips. She puts on lipstick. I mean, I think it makes people uncomfortable for those reasons.
I think the thing that people are looking to when they want to excuse the show or somehow, you know, claim counterintuitively that it's not exploitative is they look to the mom and what a complex and interesting character she is and how much she's embracing her own identity as a redneck in a self-conscious way. And it seems to me that's exactly where our outrage ought to be located. It's the fact that she, as an adult, is able to embrace, manipulate, inhabit, disinhabit an identity that separates her from her daughter, who's 6 years old. She's not capable of these things. And so the fact that she's being schooled in this kind of automaton way to inhabit pseudo-adult roles and toss off pseudo-adult gestures is what's vaguely repulsive or not so vaguely repulsive about the show. The truth is a child isn't capable of moral autonomy. They're not capable of postmodern self-conscious performances with things like gender identity or ethnic or racial identity. And that's precisely why you don't school them in those kinds of gestures. And then having schooled them in them, put them on public display and public and competitive display.
Which is just redoubled by the reality show, right? I mean, the structure of the beauty pageant is just doubled again. In the reality show, there's even more people coming to see your performance. And as you point out, the mother, June, is also a performer and a very savvy one, I think. I mean, she's essentially unflappable, right? There's all this question about weight, and she's having a weight loss contest with her daughters. And she's actually perfectly gloriously comfortable in her own 300-pound body and only loses weight, she says, to support her daughters doing it.
Yeah, and I think it is the discrepancy between those two characters, Steve, you've put your finger on it, that makes the show so uncomfortable to watch. And as likable as the mom is, I'm not going to be tuning in again.
Well, I'm so glad we found our way back to the road to perdition. Coming up, what kind of guy wants his marriage proposal to go viral? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. Thank you.
This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. Sleepwalk With Me is the new indie comedy written, directed, and starring the stand-up comedian Mike Birbiglia. It's based on his off-Broadway show, and we should say also it's co-written with Ira Glass, the famous host of This American Life. Let's listen to a clip from the movie.
I think to be a comedian, you have to be a little bit delusional. Particularly starting out, there's just so much failure. And amidst that failure, you have to tell yourself it's going quite nicely.
Julia, let me start with you. There are many delightful places to dig in with this movie, I think. But why don't we start with the easiest one? Did you like it?
Does the fact that you think there are many delightful places to dig in mean that you also found the movie delightful?
Poker face over here. I didn't mean to signal that, no. I think there are delightful things to talk about.
Okay. I was disappointed by the movie. I'm a big fan of Mike Birbiglia's work. I've listened to his radio pieces for years, and I think he's really a master of a very interesting form of comedy, which is sort of long-form storytelling studded with jokes that sometimes add up over the course of the long-form story into one massive joke that's really brilliant. I mean, I think he's a remarkable comedian. But I'd heard all these routines before. I mean, I listened to This American Life like everybody else, and I didn't feel like there was very much new material here. And I didn't feel like seeing the stories that he told so elegantly in an audio format was made any richer by witnessing them on screen.
Yeah, Dana, I would have said that this is sort of the first question to answer about this movie, other than possibly thumbs up or thumbs down, which is how well does the kind of indie rom-com format blend with or hybridize with This American Life episode? I actually didn't know Mike Birbiglia's name or work. I hadn't heard him on This American Life, so I came to it fresh. But certainly the rhythms of a This American and the tonalities of a This American Life episode are totally unmistakable in this movie.
Yeah, I barely thought of this as a rom-com at all and was surprised afterwards to read that a lot of reviews sort of thought of it as, you know, some sort of a riff on the rom-com or reinvention of the rom-com. It seemed to me, although it does focus on two things at once, Mike Birbiglia's sleepwalking problem, right? He had this strange disorder, rapid eye movement behavior disorder, I think it's called, where he acts out his dreams. So he does all kinds of crazy things in his sleep and is using things in the room as props for his dreams. That's one thread of the story. The other is that he can't bring himself to propose to his girlfriend, played by Lauren Ambrose, wonderfully, I thought. I love that character and loved her performance in the movie. And so it does have this, I guess, romantic element of the attempt to propose. But to me, it seemed more like a video essay or something. It's a very slight, small film. It's not very long. It has low production values. It feels not tossed off. It feels like something that's been carefully scripted and carefully done, but like a small autobiographical essay. And I quite liked it, actually, but didn't know any of the material since I don't listen to This American Life.
Yeah, I should say I liked it without loving it. But, Julia, what I'm interested in is really two things from the film. The first is that I couldn't help thinking over and over again how, for whatever reason these days, we're not entirely comfortable with fiction and we're not entirely comfortable with nonfiction, that we keep ending up, by hook or by crook, we keep ending up with hybrid versions of both in a weird way. And then the second thing is the cultural obsession with comedians and what makes a comedian tick and what provides them with their material and how they transmute their pain into laughs. This cultural obsession appears not to be waning one little bit. Any idea where these two impulses come from?
Yeah, on the comedy point, I mean, I've heard a ton about this movie on Marc Maron's beloved comedy podcast. Marc Maron has a cameo in the movie as a seasoned comic who tells Matt Pandemiglio, who is Mike Birbiglia's alter ego, and I believe Marc Maron's alter ego is Mark Mulhern, a little bit about life on the road. You know, Marc Maron has praised the movie extensively for depicting the life of a road comic as no one has depicted it before, with seedy motels and beds covered with pizza crusts and endless driving through strange backwaters and hostile crowds and the dreck and misery that is the life of a starting comic. I do think some of those scenes were pretty interesting, but I think your first point about why we can't just tell stories anymore is even more interesting. I mean, I found myself wishing throughout the whole movie that Mike Birbiglia had just written a romantic comedy that was informed by his own experience, but that was fresh material. And I think it might be a really good one. And maybe that he wasn't the star of. I think he was a fine performer. He's very endearing. But put Jesse Eisenberg in that role.
You just want Jesse Eisenberg in every role.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see.
But Dana, this is what I would press on a little further, which is that I almost think that the center of the movie is his ability to start using his own relationship as raw material for his comedy. And really, in a weird way, Dana, do you agree? It's about
his willingness ultimately to sacrifice that relationship to his art in a way. It's kind of an anti-coming-of-age story.
Right, and the tension from that opposition is, without spoiling anything, sort of where the dramatic resolution of the movie comes from. I mean, I guess I am really interested in the backstage life of a comic. And although the kind of how a comic becomes a comic story is something we're seeing a lot now on Louis C.K.'s show, for example, it really hasn't been a big part of the vision of comedy in the past. I was thinking about Seinfeld's show, in which he's a working comedian and you see bits of his stand-up. But there's never anything in Seinfeld about the struggle to become a comedian, right? You don't really see him agonizing over his jokes or bombing in front of an audience.
It's so interesting. I'd really never thought about this evolution of our interests, but I wonder if it's part of our larger fascination with process stories. Like, I feel like all stories now are stories of how the thing got made. I mean, there's this obsession in magazines right now of the oral history of the making of Fast Times at Ridgemont High or...
Right, or the TikTok story in journalism, right?
Yeah, like the making of is just this thing that we can't get enough of, and I think perhaps that's part of why we're seeing more of the how do you get to be Seinfeld rather than just you're Seinfeld and you got some buddies on the Upper West Side.
Well, I have another one for you. Isn't it amazing that the struggling, lonely artist who sacrifices everything to his own vision, a romantic trope now in Western culture for 300 years, one person is permitted to embody it now in contemporary culture without being laughed at, which is the comedian. He's the only person who can get away with it anymore. Let me tell you, if you pull that as a poet or a novelist, you are laughed out of the room. It's the one venue where people are still like people are so hungry for Marc Maron's podcast, which is based on that storyline, unrelentingly based on that storyline. Virtually every single one of them is talking to a comedian who reveals their emotional scars and how they turned it into comedy. The only thing people are willing to hear it turned into is comedy.
Here's a flip side theory. Maybe it's not that we're unwilling to put up with novelists or poets who want to present their inner wisdom to us anymore as a type. Maybe it's that we're not buying the resulting product. I mean, there's now money and a financial upside and a fame upside in writing comedy that is much harder to come by if you're writing novels or poetry. And maybe that's just where the seekers and storytellers of our time are going.
All right, well, behold the latest frontier in taking private life public.
My dream is to be with you every day for the rest of my life. Vicky, will you marry me?
Yes!
Julia, I'm not even sure exactly what to call these. What do you call them? Public marriage proposals, event marriage proposals, viral marriage proposals. None of them sit quite well.
I don't want a viral marriage proposal.
Catch my virus, baby.
It strikes me, correct me if I'm wrong, they're public in two related senses. The first is they take place in public, so they're often orchestrated. They involve actors, performers.
Flash mobs.
And then second, the proposal is filmed and then uploaded to YouTube and goes extremely public. One such video featured a man who had created a fake movie trailer, had a local movie theater insert it in between real trailers. And while it played, he burst into the theater, asked his girlfriend to marry him. And a video of this has been viewed 6 million times on YouTube. Julia, what the hell is going on here?
Well, make it 6 million and one times, because in preparation for this segment, I spent a 2-hour bus ride this morning watching YouTube clips of public marriage proposals on my phone. And I don't know what the people on that bus thought of me, but I just was sitting in the seat playing public marriage proposal video after public marriage proposal video. And each one struck fear and loathing into my heart because I thought, what a horrible thing to do to your bride-to-be. Meanwhile, I shed tears for every single one of them. the moment of catharsis and asking and the yes. And I just was like weeping, basically, for an hour on a bus this morning because of these stupid marriage proposal videos. So I have to recover my equanimity, I think, before I can really deliver an opinion. But
okay, so most obvious question, if they're so stupid, why do they make you weep?
Because it's this incredibly private, personal, moving moment in a human's life. I mean, it's like watching a parent cradle a baby or any other thing that you might see in a paper towel commercial. I mean, it's just a moment that's bound to pull your heartstrings. And I think part of what I resist about them is the manipulative heartstring pulling. But meanwhile, I mean, I cry at paper towel commercials, too. My heartstrings were tugged.
Mm. Dana, horrible, manipulative. We'll get to that in a second. But first, Dana, I've been meaning to ask you something for a long...
We've grown so close over these years of doing the GabFest.
I am the luckiest man alive. And I just want to – all right, anyway. You watched these. Did they make you cry? Did they tug your heartstrings? Or did they make your stomach lurch? What did
I will
you
say
think
there was
them?
There was one of the many that we queued up for our research that did make me cry. It was the Isaac James proposal, the
that
guy
is
in
the
Portland.
Best one.
It's so sweet, and I think we should link to it on our show page for sure so people can see it. In general, I find this genre of thing, whatever the marriage proposal public video is, completely spine-chilling. And most of them, I spend those 8 minutes with all of them except this Isaac James one thinking, thank God I'm not married to that person. And if I was being shown that video, I would basically take it as proof that it was not someone I wanted to spend the rest of my life with.
I agree with that, but Julia, I want to go further because I can't quite articulate it. What is it about a man that would orchestrate a massive public display of adoration as a means to proposing to a woman? What is it? What is that an indicator of about that man that might give you the heebie-jeebies?
There are several factors. Number one, he really wants a lot of attention. It is not about a private moment making a decision between two people about the rest of your lives. And thing two, it's a little bit like a dragnet closing around the bride. It is, I imagine, very hard to say no in this sort of public forum without feeling like you're humiliating someone who, if you're at the point where he is planning a proposal to you and thinks you might say yes, you probably care about at least somewhat and whom you don't want to publicly mortify. It feels a little bit like it comes out of an insecurity that you're not quite sure what the answer is going
to
be.
To me, it comes out of a massive insecurity. I don't want to condemn every single person who makes one of these things. There could be great ones out there. But a lot of the ones that we looked at made me feel that there was a massive insecurity and also a very strange form of narcissism. It really reminds me of those scenes at the end of romantic comedies, right? The inevitable scene where the hero and the heroine finally kiss and some group of people just randomly standing around on the street start applauding them, which is, I guess, this kind of dream ending to the romantic comedy, but which actually seems like some sort of voyeuristic nightmare where your private moment is suddenly on public display.
Yeah, I have to say, I just completely agree with both of you on this issue. But, you know, it linked up in my mind with one of the better moments in Sleepwalk with Me, where he finally hits upon a funny line that gets an audience to laugh, which is, my girlfriend really wants to get married, and I'm not sure whether I want to do it until I'm sure that nothing good will ever happen in my life ever again. And the audience laughs uncomfortably. But there is a way in which getting married, right, the process of getting married, which begins with the proposal, is a way of taking a huge portion of your life private on a more or less permanent basis, right? It's you become a different kind of agent in the world once you're one half of a married couple. And it's part of what you have to be able to withstand on an enduring basis is the ability to have a very large part of your life taken private, taken domestic, taken small, taken inward. And the very thing that's being betrayed by these men is, I think it's an anxiety about that, right? It's like, no, my life will always be about massive public displays, and there'll always be other people watching, and those other people will always affirm me and my choices and who I am. It seems to me direct evidence of an incapacity to follow through on the reality of marriage. I hereby commission a longitudinal study of marriages that are a result of public proposals.
Well, I was just going to step in and say that the wedding is the time that all that happens, right? It seems like the moment that you're going to have your big, crazy, flash mob, fancy display and, you know, teach your Uncle Ned to do cartwheels down the aisle or something is at the wedding itself. But are we being too judgy? Do we need somebody in the empty chair over there saying, come on, guys, take it easy. Public proposal videos are not that bad, and there's something sort of sweet and moving about them?
No, I think we're being just the right amount of judgy. I mean, the other thing I would say is that I think the public proposal video is perhaps an answer to the hugeness of the modern wedding. The bride, I mean, it's the bride and groom, but typically the bride, the show is called Bridezilla for a reason, now has this day upon which tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars are often expected to be spent, where all sorts of things are choreographed, where she gets a show to put on. And the guy doesn't necessarily get a show. I mean, it depends on the relationship, it depends on the couple, this, that, and the other. And so it makes sense that there would be the escalation of the proposal, too, at this moment.
Yeah, maybe you're right. This is the groomzilla aspect to balance out the bridezilla side, right? And it's the moment that the guy gets to put on a show. But when you were talking about, you know, turning the whole thing into a performance, it suddenly occurred to me that the worst aspect of some of these videos is that an actor is actually hired to play both of the two characters, right? If you're going to act out the story of how they met, how they fell in love in the laundromat, the cute meet, whatever, you can't obviously get your girlfriend to do it because the game will be given away. So, for example, in the David Pogue video, the New York Times tech writer David Pogue, who produced one of these things, a fake movie trailer one, he hires an actress, I guess, a woman who looks sort of like the girl he's going to propose to. And so that in itself, there's just a strange artificiality of sitting there watching these people play you and your love being sort of turned into this spectacle where you're not yourselves at precisely the moment when you should be most authentic and most yourselves and say, you are the person I want.
Can I tell you guys and give our listeners a word of advice about how to incredibly elegantly deflect a public marriage proposal?
Oh, my God, yes.
Please.
So a friend of a friend, it's not an internet public marriage proposal, but it was a marriage proposal with an audience. A friend of a friend works in PR. And she was visiting New York with her boyfriend, and they were on a Circle Line cruise around New York City. And the boyfriend had arranged with the ship captain to stop under the Brooklyn Bridge, very scenic, the sun was setting. And in front of all the other tourists on the Circle Line cruise boat, he got down on one knee and said, "Darling, will you marry me?" And she gasped in glee, pulled him into a hug, whispered in his ear, "When we let go of this hug, we're going to pretend I said yes. Ask me again in a year." Let go. The whole boat celebrated. He asked her again in a year. They eventually got married. Cool as a cucumber, right?
Wow, that's really thinking on your feet, I have to say.
All right, let's endorse. Dana, what do you have?
So I'm going to endorse these series of very short 2-minute films called Mysteries Vernacular. I actually saw one of them as a short playing before the Mike Birbiglia film at the IFC Center. They're by a director named Jessica Orek, and her project is to take every letter of the alphabet, pick a word that begins with that letter that has an interesting etymology, and make a little 2-minute stop-motion animation about the etymology. The word at the showing of the movie I saw was pants, which had a completely unexpected and interesting etymology. She's only made 6 of these so far, but she's going to make one for every letter of the alphabet, and they're tons of fun to watch, and they teach you a ton about language, and you can find them at Mysteries of Vernacular.
Ah, that sounds so cool, Dana. Julia, what do you have?
My endorsement, Last Chance Summer Reading Blowout. This Labor Day weekend, you should succumb to the chatter that you've no doubt heard in the air and get Gone Girl, which is the wildly popular best-selling book by Gillian Flynn. I'd never read any of her books before, but this book has been going around Slate like a virus, like a viral wedding video. Literally every Slate editor who's departed on vacation has read it and come back singing its praises. And now that I have gone off on vacation, I can report it is true. It is a really vivid, very readable portrait of one of the most dark, screwed up marriages that you've ever read about. And the plotting and the thriller elements are really well handled as well. I mean, you just can't stop turning. It has the page turnability of Dan Brown, but then the sentences are good and they don't make you want to poke your eyes out. So highly recommend. Soak it up for your last beach weekend of the summer.
Excellent. And you walk away with both eyes. I love it.
Best kind of reading experience.
All right. Well, I'm going to endorse an essay. GQ magazine is celebrating its 50th anniversary by republishing some of its favorite pieces from its archives. There's an essay from 2007 up on their website by an author named Tom Junod, whose byline I'm not familiar with. And I have to say now I'm embarrassed. It's about his father. And his father, as I take it from the essay, was sort of a greatest generation guy, a band leader and a singer who is impossibly handsome and beautifully turned out man. And it's about the dressing and personal grooming tips that his father gave him over the years, which comprised an inordinate amount of their relationship. And it's over the course of the essay, you begin to get this not only a portrait of this remarkable man who not only women but men responded to just as a physical being, an elegant, perfectly turned out physical being, but also as a man who used clothes and personal appearance as a way of presenting a face to the public world while keeping another one extremely, extremely private. And it's only over the course of the essay that you begin to realize that it's not just that this man is sort of a shallow clothes source, but at some level he's a man with a kind of deep interior life that he feels no obligation to share, even with his son. And that becomes the substance of their relationship. It's an essay I hope to teach if I teach nonfiction writing again, because it is one of the most beautifully wrought examples of show, don't tell. It's just a lovely essay. Kudos. Anyway, Dana.
Steven.
Julia.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's show and to the podcast version of the Political and Culture Gabfests at wnyc.org/gabfest. Our email address is gabfestradio@slate.com. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Mike Vuolo and Dan Pashman. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Sally Tamarkin. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For David Plotz and the rest of the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. See you next week. Is it the look in your eyes?